August of 1973, Jan-Erik Olsson walked into Credit Banken in Stockholm, fired a few rounds into the ceiling, and announced in a fairly convincing American accent, "This is a robbery." The cops turned out in force and surrounded the bank, and then Olsson took four of the bank employees hostage. They were Kristin Enmark, Birgitta Lundblad, Elizabeth Olren, and Sven Sevström. The police were completely unprepared to deal with a situation that, as the Swedish press said at the time, and as some of the hostages themselves said later, was thought only to happen in America. And that won't be the first time that you hear that kind of sentiment, either tonight or in episodes to come. So Olsson demanded the equivalent of $700,000, two guns, bulletproof vests, and a Ford Mustang as his getaway car. And he also wanted his old prison buddy, Clark Olofsson, released from jail and, you know, brought to the bank. Once Olofsson was inside, he tried to act as a mediator between Olsson and the cops in an effort to protect the hostages and also to, you know, have his sentence commuted in some way. So what followed over the next 6 days was the police continually trying to outsmart Olsson and only creating more confusion and tension, you know, in the process. So at one point, they misidentified Olsson as another armed robber called Kaj Hansen. And then they sent Hansen's brother and a cop into the bank to negotiate. The police then only realized that they'd screwed up when Olsson opened up on Hansen's brother and the cop. And then Hansen himself phoned them from his hideout in Hawaii to let them know that he was totally innocent in this particular situation. And in the process, just incidentally, he actually unwittingly tipped the Swedish police off to his location, and then they extradited him from Hawaii back to Sweden. So the cops tried to drill a hole into the wall of the bank as well so that they could kind of surreptitiously peek in on Olsson, and he noticed the spy hole immediately and fired at it. The psychiatrist the police brought in as a consultant during the standoff, this was Niels Bejerot, he was seeming to go out of his way to antagonize Olsson and piss him off. And then the hostages began to grow increasingly convinced that the situation was going to end in a bloodbath. And by the third day, 3/4 of Sweden's entire population was tuning in to watch the TV coverage of this hostage situation. So Kristin Enmark decided, as she put it, to strategically befriend Olsson to try to make him empathize with the hostages. And it actually seems to have worked. I mean, at least up to a point, they were allowed to call their families and friends. And at one point, Kristin even spoke to the Prime Minister of Sweden, Olof Palme. And she spent almost an hour in tears telling him about her fears, about her concern over how the police were managing the negotiations, you know, and expressing a growing belief that she wasn't getting out of it alive. Palme told her that she could take solace in knowing she was a fine employee at Credit Banken, and if the police did eventually raid the bank and she was killed during a shootout, at least she'd die at her post with honour. Seriously, he actually said that to her. And then on the sixth day of the standoff, the police did indeed attack the bank. They used gas canisters to blind and confuse Olsson before arresting him and freeing the hostages. None of the hostages were especially impressed with the way the cops had prolonged the standoff and exacerbated the situation, you know. And then Kristin Enmark went on Swedish radio shortly afterwards to criticize Niels Bejerot directly. Now, Bejerot, without ever meeting her, claimed that Kristin and the other hostages, in, you know, criticizing the police more severely than Olsson and in trying to befriend Olsson, were displaying symptoms of a psychological condition that he termed Norrmalmstorgssyndrome. Nobody outside Sweden had the patience to learn how to pronounce that, least of all me, so we just took to calling it Stockholm Syndrome. And then a year later, Patty Hearst was maybe but not really kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army. And the press said that her transformation into a gun-toting left-wing outlaw had all the classic signs of Stockholm Syndrome. Classic signs as if this had been long established, you know, and not just something that was made up the year before. And then since then, we've used this term to describe all sorts of situations where victims apparently come to sympathize with or even like fall in love with their kidnappers or abusers or what have you. And it's all because nobody really appreciates that the term was coined by a man who was feeling defensive about the incredibly shitty job he did handling a hostage crisis and who was damned if he was going to take any shit off a girl who didn't even have a PhD, friends. So I bring up Stockholm Syndrome because it illustrates something that we'll be expanding on as we tell the story of Olof Palme, his assassination, and frankly, Sweden as well in the second half of the 20th century. Because we have official narratives, you know, these are the things that we all believe, or we're all taught to believe at least, about big moments in history. But then we have that layer above that, which is the cherished myth, you know. The Soviets were kind of bit players in World War II, and it was really the Americans and the British that won that war. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And we cling to these cherished myths because they appear to explain the world in a neat way that doesn't disturb the sleep. So it's easier for everyone to believe that one hysterical woman at a bank fell in love with the guy who took her hostage. It's easier to believe that than it is to believe that an entire police force and their hired psychiatrist might be totally full of shit and not really have a clue what they were doing. For people who only have a broad familiarity with everything that we're going to discuss tonight and in episodes to come, it's easier to believe that Olof Palme was a shining example of how you do left-wing politics in the context of Western capitalism. It's easier to believe, I guess, that he was killed because of his politics by dark forces that he was totally unaware of and even antagonistic towards. And it's easier to believe that Sweden was and is otherwise a shining beacon of progressivism that we should all be aspiring towards in a world where major countries are shifting further and further to the right by the day. So what we're going to do in the weeks ahead, hopefully, is aim some well-placed shots at this edifice of cherished mythology around Olof Palme and Sweden and its context in the Cold War. And we're going to try to offer an alternative view of the last few decades of Swedish and even European history. So we are, as James Ellroy once said, we are going to embrace bad men and the price they paid to secretly define their time. And then we are going to ask one final question. What now?
I had a dream about this place.
Ghost Stories for the End of the World, and we're kicking off the big return to Europe with the story of Olof Palme, his assassination, and why it still matters. But as we said at the top of the show, you can't talk about any of this without discussing Sweden, its history after World War II, its place in the geopolitical intrigue of the Cold War. So we're also going to be discussing that as well. Tonight in this first installment, we are starting broad, right? We're going to offer a overview of all of that and give you guys a kind of Sweden 101. And then we're going to close with a step-by-step account of Palme's murder. And I'm joined for this by Marcus of the Return of the Repressed podcast.
Hello.
And Sebastian, a unlicensed private investigator. Both of them are authentic Swedes, and I thought that was the best way to kick off this return to the dark heart of Europe. And what better way than with like one of the most notorious political assassinations in Europe in the latter half of the 20th century. So how are you guys? Good?
Yeah, doing all right over here on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I think we're going to have a lot of fun today.
Yeah, yeah. This is fucking wild, this story. Okay, so we're talking about Olof Palme and why his murder matters. And we're also going to be talking about Sweden in broader terms, really, in not just in the 80s, but, you know, in the years before and after Olof Palme's murder. And the legacy of the assassination as well. We are going to go deep too. I thought I knew this story until I met these guys, and it turned out I don't know shit. Sketches a broad overview of Sweden in the 80s and Olof Palme in general.
Okay, Marcus, do you want to take the lead?
Yeah, I can do that. I can start off. We're honored by this, introduction, but in the league of Swedish knowledge about Palme, we certainly do not know that much. I think like it doesn't really matter, you know, whatever we will eventually say, there is definitely going to be among your Swedish listeners a lot of people who are disappointed that we didn't bring up their favorite lead or their favorite tidbit or their favorite anecdote, etc., etc. But I hope, yeah, you know, that I'll be able to answer what you just asked of me and give some kind of an introduction that isn't too generic. Like, you know, even if you feel like you know a little bit, you should be able to feel that something new was provided. And hopefully, even if you feel like you know a lot, maybe something new will be introduced. For other reasons than those reasons, like the amount of interest that this have in the public consciousness of the north of Europe, at least, it's of course impossible also to give a full picture of what is possibly the world's longest murder investigation. I mean, it's estimated, I think, that it would take about 9 years to read through the official material alone. And, you know, that would require professional familiarity with legal texts. So, yes, that's crazy.
Yeah, I think the amount of pages is somewhere over 700,000 in the official, not including the books and articles and stuff like
yes.
that.
Yes,
yeah.
A visual image of that is like that's 250 shelf meters of stuff.
Yeah, that's so, crazy.
Yeah, I mean... If even like, you know, a focus on a particular lead, like that of Stig Engström, the Skandia man, which have now recently been put down as the most likely, unlikely killer, then, or, you know, everything that lies behind him, let's say, like Stay Behind and the very company that he worked for, we'll only hope to scratch the surface, right? So still... in this very first episode, I hope we'll get something, right? So, I mean, almost of those, you know, meters of shelf material then, like 130 people have pleaded guilty alone and almost 100,000 different names are mentioned in connection with the murder in the official report.
Yeah, and just imagine how fucked up that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, why would you claim a murder, you know?
So these are 130 people who've come forward, like, claiming credit for the murder.
I think we should end the show with Matt claiming the murder.
Just to see, and then we back him up, like, and we split the reward money.
The main thing that I kind of engaged with when I first started reading about this years ago was the fact that it is unsolved. It's created like a void, and it becomes almost like a Rorschach test, and people can read what they want into the murder and what it means to them, you know. And it's interesting how, I mean, we'll be getting into this a lot later on, but it is interesting how even like the security services and the police have used it as much the same. Like, they've used it to sort of settle scores or, you know, build up their own pet theories about what was behind it, even though a lot of those theories are deliberate bullshit.
Right. Like, yeah, you even have like state apparatuses fighting each other. Like, it's not just the leads of you know, private investigators or you know, authors of books. In addition to that, I mean, what makes it, I don't remember, but I know what you mean by the word you said. You mean that sort of the kind of, like the vase, right? Do you see two faces or do you see a vase? I can't remember what the psychology was. What was it called? Something R, right?
A Rorschach test, you know, like an imp block test. So you've shown an image and it's what you see in that image tells you a lot about yourself, you know, allegedly. That's the theory anyway.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that might add to that being, you know, very much the case is that there is almost no technical evidence, like in the traditional sense, right? So there's no DNA, no fingerprints or footprints, no found murder weapon. And even the two bullets that were found, you know, they can't with certainty be linked to the, obviously, you know, since there is no murder weapon, they can't certainly be linked with the with that murder weapon. So, I mean, there's a lot of... that's problematic if you're going to solve a crime, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we'll be getting into more specifics about why there is no physical evidence relating to this murder. That'll be a little bit later on, though. But that in and of itself should tell us quite a lot about maybe some of the motives of the investigators and whatnot, the fact that the investigation was so botched from the beginning.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously now, like, you know, because it was only... Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was last year, right? Or was it the year before last that they finally closed? Yeah, then basically this the longest running murder investigation in history. And And so, you know, and like I said, right, they did that with concluding that it was this man called Stig Engström.
Yeah, so this is June 2020, I think, when they announced that he was the prime suspect, but because he was already dead, they were unsure as well whether they even had enough evidence to have actually convicted him had he been alive.
Yeah, so they closed down the investigation with the account of him being dead.
Yeah, and I think they said, I think one of the concluding remarks was like, there is no way we can get around him. I mean that can mean either that we have so much evidence against him, or it can mean basically, yeah, that he's dead. So, I mean, you can't get around a corpse then, I guess, if you want him to speak about something.
I remember you were saying the other day that there is a lot of kind of noirish aspects to this story. And I think how unedifying it is the way it ends, which is to say it doesn't really end. We just can't take it any further forward. That is so noir in and of itself, you know. It's just this complete lack of... closure to the whole thing.
Right. It's just an empty street, sort of. And then there's like the fin or something.
Yeah.
And then
it's
like, what? Please, more. I think, though, it seems, I mean, because there are other things, you know, in connection to this, which we will get into later. I already mentioned, you know, something like Stay Behind. Mm-hmm. We should know that Stay Behind, the Swedish Stay Behind, is like the only European... you know, of all the Gladio projects that hasn't been acknowledged at all official repressive apparatus. Like, I mean, they have hinted at it being the case. And since Norway and Denmark have basically admitted that, you know, this was taking place, obviously Sweden has to be involved somehow. But so I think, you know, with more things like this popping up, for sure, we there will be more and more pieces of the puzzle falling into place, right? But maybe what we're lacking is just the narrative, right? So that's why we're sitting down today to, you know, speak upon this. Because the reason, like, you know, how can it be, you know, that this man then, the Skandia man, the Engström, why didn't he, you know, why is it up until, you know, what was it that made sure that they now with certainty can say that they can't get around him? Why was, you know, what happened to him prior to that? And for those who have seen, you know, like the Netflix TV series, I'm sure you had similar questions, you know, like, why he seems like a pretty likely, unlikely murder, right? Like, how can it be that, why was he put away eventually Hans Holmér, who is the man who takes over the investigation, who leads his own task force. So I'll get into him in a bit, but, you know, he basically just refers to him on paper as being on site. I mean, neither a witness nor a suspect.
He's just ambiently there.
Yeah. Which is it's such an awkward title, right? That he just invents for this person who now, you know, it makes it even more awkward, obviously, now. And the first independent journalistic, you know, investigation to draw attention to Engström was the newspaper The Proletarian, which is the most famous Marxist-Leninist paper in Sweden and the most the longest running communist one, I think. And they didn't, I mean, Engström appears, the Skandia man appears in this paper initially as a sort of scoop to the police lead, which is basically, you know, the theory that there was a conspiracy within the police to assassinate Olof Palme. Now I'm saying it like you, man. What the fuck did you do to me? Yeah. In that paper, like initially Engström, he was not suspected then, you know, but he was treated as a witness with information about this police lead. And the fact that he was dismissed as a witness was taken as a sign that the police were afraid, you know, of what he had to say about them. But when it was revealed some months later that a group of policemen separate, you know, to the investigation team of Hans Holmér, which again, that is, he's the, not only the head of the Palme Investigation Task Force in the beginning, but he is also a former secret police head. So we already see the contours of some, what we referred to earlier, sort of contradiction between the different state apparatuses.
But before we get to that, I'm wondering, Matt, how much do you know of Olof Palme, the man?
A soft left. I'm not saying this is what I think. This is just how he's kind of sold to us in the West. Like a soft left guy who set the example for how you could do it, you know, as a leftist in electoral politics in the West. Like a bloodless revolutionary, you know? Mm-hmm. And certainly like...
That's a nice title, actually.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the Scandinavian-style social democrat of all Scandinavian-style social democrats, you know. Basically the model, I think, for what like Corbyn and Bernie were held up as being.
I think so too. Agree.
Yeah. And someone that leftists in the mainstream, I would say, in like Britain and America, kind of point to reassure like the more conservative and right-leaning parts of the electorate that this can be done, you know, and you don't have to lose any money as a result of it being done. I would say that's basically what my impression of him was, you know, before I started kind of digging deeper into him.
Yeah,
it's kind of like political pragmatism of some.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know how much your listeners know about Sweden at this time and in this period, but if we go over it a little bit brief, then, you know, it's Sweden staying out of the Second World War, allegedly, at least. And then building up all of this, like the welfare state or the Swedish model, as it's known. And I think at the time of Palme's murder, he had been like a politician for a very long time, right? So he was, he was 59 when he was killed in 1986.
And this wasn't his first term either, was it? As
no, it was his fifth term. Yeah. Yeah. So he was actually prime minister in two separate periods. First from 1969 to 1976. And then he lost an election. And it was the first time that the Social Democratic Party lost an election in Sweden, I think, in like 4 decades.
Yeah.
So they had been ruling for a very long time.
As the most successful democratic party, right? Like in the world. Like in terms of how long they have served, like in a parliament, like in a democratic, well, bourgeoisie democratic parliament.
Yeah, exactly. And Palme, he had been coming up under this the previous guy, Tage Erlander, and had been in his cabinet for a long time before as well. So he had been basically in politics for all of his adult or even in his youth, so for all of his life. And he was this figurehead of the Scandinavian style social democracy.
He was kind of beloved, wasn't he, like outside of Sweden by a lot of developing nations. Like, I think I may be wrong about this, but I think he was the first Western leader to visit Cuba after the revolution.
Yeah, I just remember in the documentary, there's like a lot of footage when he does visit Cuba, and he even gets, you know, sort of like those portraits, like classical communist, you know, party head portraits, like that you will see of like Mao, yeah, Marx or Lenin or, well, Castro himself, and you know, a huge one, like I don't know how many meters, like, you know, as they greet him at the airport in Cuba. But yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know, like, you know, that's the thing, right? Like, there's so many different images to this person. I mean, Sebe knows a lot more than I do about, like, actually how many different, you know, faces there are to this person. But like you said, like, I think, you know, being beloved, I mean, he was really liked, especially in Sweden, you know, very popular prime minister. Like, you know, he was disappearing a bit towards the end.
Yeah, I think we'll get to those things a little bit later. What I'm thinking about is if we, broadly speaking, that put in context the state of Sweden that he inherited. So, for example, during Tage Erlander, the previous prime minister, that was the prime minister for 23 years. Just like imagine that. Like this guy before Olof Palme was for 23 fucking years. The same guy without losing an election, you know. And those were the days under this guy Erlander that the state got really involved with doing a lot of like building what is known as the welfare state, right?
Yeah.
So already when Palme got into office, they had some reforms, of course, in the early years, but his terms were plagued by a lot of scandals and a lot of conflict within the party as well. That we will get into a little bit later. But he basically inherited this this party and the government when they had the majority, you know, in the parliament. So they had over 50% of the votes in the beginning. So they could basically do whatever they wanted to in terms of policies and reforms. And then when we get into his second term, then it's they lose this majority and they cannot enact on their policies the same way. And then, of course, we have the side of him internationally, like you said, all of his trips to the third world.
And also, like, adding to what you said there, like, I mean, the fact that they're losing in popularity also means that now there's gonna, you know, they're gonna have to make a lot of more compromises to stay in power, which makes everything a lot more, you know, volatile, like tender, how to say, delicate, right? Like, it's easier for things to break at this point.
Yeah, that's something that we should probably point out, isn't it? Which is, he was broadly popular, but that kind of conservative business class in Sweden fucking hated him.
Yeah. So hated. Like,
And so it's not like he was this universally worshipped guy, even in Sweden. He had a lot of kind of antagonistic forces that he had to contend with.
I have a little list, actually, like, of everybody, like broader, like, historical blocks or apparatuses within the state that might have, you know, that would paint this picture, like, who hated him, basically.
His enemies list.
Yeah, the kill the pig list. Well, it would be the opposite, right? Everybody who wants to kill the pig list. Yeah.
I think that something that we'll be getting into a lot in future episodes, but we can probably mention now, is a pretty significant part of his, I suppose we could call it his foreign policy, or certainly his foreign policy opinions, was that he was an ardent critic of the apartheid regime in South Africa as well,
yeah,
which did not make him very popular with fellow Western leaders, Thatcher, Reagan.
Right, like the white bloc of Africa, basically.
Exactly, right. And this is, like, if we back away from Sweden, we see at this time, in the 80s, we have, like you mentioned, the Thatcher, Reagan, all of these guys, and the security state and the intelligence states in the Western world, like, really upping the ante, so to speak.
They are completely off the leash in the 1980s. I mean, obviously, we're just coming off the back of the Octopus series on the show. And it's a high tide of, like, intelligence agency bloodshed, you know.
And we will get into this more in the next episode, but we will see how the shift in the U.S.-Swedish relations during his early days, because it was not as antagonistic in the beginning, right? So,
not as anti-imperialist as one would like to believe, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a key feature of this story, really, is that nothing is really as you've come to believe it actually is. Once you actually start doing the reading and getting deep into it, you realize a lot of your previous assumptions were wrong.
Yeah, and especially as a Swede, like, you really feel, you know, all the talk about, like, cult personalities and stuff. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, point a finger at an entire people and a nation and perhaps a person which you know nothing about and say, you know, that they are, you know, that they're engaging in some kind of personality cult. But, I mean, it's difficult for a Swedish person, I mean, me included, to sort of one by one, you know, take away things that you were brought up to believe about, well, essentially, who, you know, the man who's supposed to be sort of the most important person of your nation for during the 20th century.
So you were saying that towards the end, the year or so leading up to his murder, he was kind of dropping off in popularity. So I guess we could say that the murder kind of made a martyr of him in some ways, you know.
Yeah, in a way, maybe.
Sort of, it actually helped cement his legacy, as cold as that sounds.
Yeah, it's kind of that Caesaristic touch, right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
By the time Caesar gets killed, we know there are not going to be any more, you know, great wars of exploitation and loot somehow. You know, there is actually really nothing left for the Caesar but to die at that point somehow. I don't know if, you know, that might not directly correlate with Palme, but maybe. Yeah, I'm doing it again. but maybe there is something to it, you know? Like, I was going to go, I mean, if you wanted to paint, you know, the image like of somebody who's lovable and like neutral, like, so I went back to sort of Sweden, like in World War II, right? Like, I mean, usually every story starts with World War II. But so in Sweden, I mean, most people in Sweden who are like somewhat self-respecting knows that we weren't really neutral, like during the Second World War. And, you know, we would favor whichever side was winning, meaning that up until 1943, when the events of, 41 and 42, which is like Stalingrad, El Alamein, and the U.S. declaration of war on Germany, etc., turned out to be, you know, not mere exceptions to German war luck. We aided relatively unhindered the Germans with weapons the manufacturing of weapons. So, I mean, the major thing is that I touched upon that in one of my episodes about like the early sort of bourgeoisie relationships that Germany made before Germany became a nation. It sort of had its, there was a Germany before there was a Germany, which was basically like a sort of like, you know, same Stahl und Kohl, like steel and coal organization of industrialists, basically. And one of
EU,
something like a EU,
yeah,
like a große deutsche EU, right, like a bigger, greater German EU, where Scandinavian countries are also seen as Germanic countries. You know, it's got that kind of touch to it. And so, Sweden was important in that sense because the world's largest iron ore mine is found in the north of Sweden. And so what we call the Malmbanan, like the, it's an infamous like iron ore line. It goes from Nazi-occupied Norway to the Finland in the east, right? And so it was used for the production commodities that needed to be shipped to keep the war going, and other heavy industrial, you know, heavy industry production commodities, and also some of those high-tech precision parts. They were very necessary for German war industry.
Yeah.
And so, this history is still unfolding. Like, we still don't really know how much we helped the Germans. And, you know, obviously there's a bit of friction to let the world know just how helpful we were. But since we're on a British podcast, we could summarize by quoting your good Winston Churchill, who said that Sweden, quote, "Sweden ignored major moral issues in the war and played both sides for profit." That was terrible, but yeah, that's what he said. So, I mean, this...
I mean, America did the same, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
for sure.
It's not a uniquely Swedish trait, I would say.
No,
I think not. Pretty much everyone wanted to do business with Germany until Germany turned around and fucked everybody.
Yeah, I mean, my thesis is basically that since the Napoleonic Wars, there's been definitely been like an industrial and banking oligarchy, which is international enough to profit from either side of the wars. But still, I mean, the nation state isn't just a matter of appearance, you know, so they still have to sort of, you know, they can't just declare outright global anarchy and you know, suggest that we are all going to be, you know, puppets of various different dynasties of corporations. That wouldn't really, you know, that wouldn't sit tight with everybody. So, so maybe Sweden can be like sort of the signifier for this kind of behavior, but as a nation state. But since, you know, obviously this nation state is also, you know, made up by some of those international oligarchs, right?
So it's after the war, and Sweden starts building up this this welfare state, and it starts making a name for itself as a kind of left-leaning, I guess, like liberal democracy and whatnot. What prompted that, and why was there no kind of push, or was there a pushback, in fact, from like the more conservative kind of industrialists and business class in the country?
I think to answer this, or to get the full picture, you have to really go to the heart of what, you know, social democracy is. And because in the early, like in 1910s, 1920s, the Swedish working class were amongst the most, like, how do you say, prone to conflict. And it was actually very close that the proletariat in Sweden had their own revolution, right? So you have to see social democracy as an answer to this. So even in the beginning, the Social Democratic Party, and you can see this similarities if you look in Germany, for example, during the time with Liebknecht and Luxembourg, that the Social Democratic Party is filled with all of these ghouls, right? So I'm not saying that everybody is. So you had the true believers that really thought that you could come to socialism through reform. But you also open up the door for a lot of people from the upper classes to take advantage of this. And this is something that you can see, like, I think this will be an episode in itself, but you can see this throughout the history of the Swedish Social Democratic Party. And this is what Palm is a part of, and we will see like this legacy of enacting reforms that are demanded by the working class, and then, but they don't do it without the popular demand. So that they're always doing these types of reforms. They're calling out on the Vietnam War and stuff like this. But this is because you have the popular, the masses, a mass base that is demanding this this type of politics.
Also puts me in mind of like the creation of the NHS here in Britain was very much a kind of a response to people coming back from the war and demanding, you know, reforms. And at the time, it was kind of like, well, if we don't do this, there is a very decent chance, you know, that we could have some kind of like socialist elected into power, and then we're really fucked, you know. So it seems like, if I take what you're saying right, it seems like social democracy, in a sense, has been kind of instrumentalized as a weapon against more revolutionary currents in Swedish society. Used to dilute.
Yeah, and you know, if you read the old texts and documents, they from the 30s and the 40s, and the they are always referred to as social fascists.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is like how the left saw the Social Democratic Party. It's really like that the Social Democratic Party is the, like, how do you say, the rational or the logical bourgeois response to these class demands from the working class.
We could say that, like, the disciplination of the productive forces is not only in the interest of the historical necessity towards communism. There are also some people who would like to see that everybody shows up on time and with NHS are healthy enough to do the work that they're asked to do.
So if we go back then and look at the Swedish model, it was always, you know, they call it a deal between Swedish capital and between Swedish labor. But it was through the Social Democratic Party and through the unions that have been co-opted by the leaders of the Social Democratic Party. So in a sense, you had these spokespersons that were always connected to the party that closed the deals and with the Swedish heavy industry, for example. So when they then after the war builds up the welfare state, it's always with the interest of Swedish capital in mind, and it's always to not go too far. And this is something that we will see that changes in the 80s, for example, like I said before, that the right wing in the 80s are like completely unhinged, you know, so it's like they get high on their own supply. And then they just start to believe all of their crazy propaganda, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the 80s is very much the kind of right-wing pushback in the West begins in earnest, I guess, against that like post-war consensus, that deal that had been reached between capital and labor everywhere, really. I wonder if it feels like there was a sense that the USSR wasn't long for this world in the 80s. And I think that definitely emboldened them a lot. It was kind of, we're nearly there, just keep pushing, you know, like push harder sort of thing.
Yeah, and then you have the roots, like the grassroots of the right wing. Those guys, you know, they don't know all the plans. They are not in these meetings and getting the full picture, and they're just amping up and amping up and getting more, you know, crazier by the minute. And we see this in the 70s, for example, and in the 80s, that it's getting worse, and the propaganda against the Soviet Union, for example, it's amping up. And I think it was really a sense in the, not only in Sweden, but in all of Europe, that this was coming to an end, you know.
Yeah, in the beginning of the 80s that both the Holodomor, you know, mythology and the discrediting of the Great Leap Forward as a man-made famine. I mean, people had spoken about that before as being, you know, just a famine, and now the narrative is that look, this is what communists do. They murder millions, tens of millions of their own people by starving them to death. And so, I mean, yeah, it's like, it's a different time, like this time. And then, you know, this also points towards, again, like, you know, what kind of role then Palme as a middleman, as, you know, he sees himself as an anti-imperialist who is at the same time an anti-capitalist and an anti-communist, right? That's the ideal social democrat position to take. And so, you know, how are you going to play that game when the middle point is, you know, dramatically shifted to the right by the sheer lunacy of people like Reagan and Thatcher et al, you know? That's a difficult game to play.
I guess in broad terms, then, I'm curious about how he did actually handle his time in office, you know, in the 80s. We'll be getting into this in much more detail in episodes to come. But just broadly, like, so he arrives, it's the 80s, the right is kind of insurgent. How did he respond to that, or did he respond to that?
Yeah, in 1976, right, he loses the election. So he's not in government until 1982 again, when he comes back. And just in those years, in those 6 years, it's a completely different landscape, right? So it was a lot that happened during that time. For example, you had the Iran-Iraq war. You had in Sweden, if we look more closer to home, you had the submarine scandals of the 80s. So there was a lot of scandals about Soviet submarines in the Swedish archipelago. And now, like maybe, 40 years later, we have a lot of evidence that points that maybe it was NATO submarines, you know, and this was a pop.
Yeah,
and
sometimes our own as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like Swedish.
But, a shock.
Yeah.
But this is also an episode in itself, but just this sense of paranoia, you know, oh my God, Sweden is under attack.
I have a nice tidbit about that paranoia, like it just 1 second. Like, so have you heard about the Marine commander von Hofsten? Did you hear about him? The fleet commander Hans von Hofsten.
Go on, yeah.
It's a bit, yeah. So this guy, his major thesis was that Palme was controlled like telepathically, kind of like Yuri's Revenge style, by the KGB to like allow these submarines. And later, like, I mean, and he didn't just think this, like the latter stages of his paranoia, he and some other like chiefs of the secret police started this kind of mission where they would stop, trucks coming from Poland and stuff, like delivering, you know, groceries, you know, and searching for these mind control devices inside, like, yeah. Like, you know, piles of cabbage and stuff like that. Like, it's just really crazy stuff. But but it's not just like a funny tidbit, because people, I mean, have suggested that he brought almost at least, you know, the army nobility within the Marine to a sort of almost the verge of organizing an actual mutiny, like year, you know, in the months leading up to the assassination. But
So like an actual military coup.
Within the Marines. So, I mean, that has happened before, right? Like, those tend to be the most famous ones when the Marine do stuff. So, I mean, that, even though he is obviously off his tits, like he's an insane person, but still, like, if people believe him, you know, then it might have some material effect, right? It's not just his own crackpot theories about the state of the world. But go on.
Yeah, but so when he comes back into office in 82, first of all, he's no longer in a much weaker position politically. The party doesn't have the majority in together with the coalition like they had before. So they're a minority government. They cannot rule as they were used to, because like I said, when he lost in 76, he was the first to lose in like 40 years. So, of course, this must have had a huge impact on him, like personally as well.
Yeah, it's quite a big black mark against his career, I guess, is that?
Yeah, exactly. So in the years between, before he came back, then he was focusing more on this international side. He was a mediator in the war between Iran and Iraq, and he was traveling around the world, giving speeches and stuff like this. So a lot of what we know about him is actually from his year when he was in opposition and not in the government and had all this time. But so when he gets back, the landscape is a little bit different. And I would say that the two major political topics during this time, these last 4 years in office before his murder, was the this question about the submarines and the Soviets being in Swedish water, and the question about employee funds. I don't know if you know about the
wage taker funds, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so yeah. What was that, the employee funds?
It's an interesting topic, this one. It's close to my heart, this one.
Yeah, but it's basically that the laborers get a part of the profits that are put into special like trusts or funds for the workers. So that and this is very simple terms. We can like debate about the details, and there are a lot of because they were presented as a socialist reform But there's a lot of debate if there it's actually like a socialist or if it's communist or if it's just social democratic trick, you know. But anyway, so in broad terms, it's a part of the profits should be reinvested into the company, into funds that are goes to the employers or the employees. So then all of the wage earners or the employees, they would have a direct interest, an economic interest in the company that they work. And this is something that was, when you read today or when you hear about it, it's very closely connected to Olof Palme, for example. But he was actually against it. Okay, so this is, goes back
yeah, that's,
to
yeah, what, that's the funny thing.
Yeah, this goes back to what we were talking about with the grassroots and what the masses want, right?
If I remember his quote correctly, he said something like, "The wage earner funds are terrible, but we have no choice but to go through with it." Is
yeah,
basically his words. Yeah.
Yeah, and he also has a lot of quotations about him not wanting to be the one that destroys the party. He doesn't want to be remembered as the one that is destroying the party. And this was a very...
Because you can see here like a sort of shift, I think. Like I read one book that sort of collected a lot of like articles on this wage taker fund from this period. And you can see the sort of... I mean, we know more about this demarcation today, that there is already sort of a split in the party at this time, like between a more, you know, let's say, they, you know, traditionally or classically, we say either democratic socialists or social democrats, right? So that there is one, you know, a right wing, more right wing side and one more left wing, like Sebe said earlier, true believers who actually thinks that social democracy is a sort of... reform towards, well, socialism and then maybe communism or, you know, something better. Whereas, well, the cynicist, realpolitik, social democrats, they know this is the best way to, yeah, once again, disciplinate the productive forces and give them just as much as they, you know, demand so that we can keep making profits, right? So that,
exactly. And it's also a way of moving, you know, moving the power base from the capitalists to maybe the unions, for instance, or to the party. So it is that they want to take away power from the capitalists, but it's not giving it directly to the workers. Because even if the workers, for example, would take part of this these wage earner funds, they're not the ones controlling them, right? So, of course, you would still have it being through the unions.
I saw like one DDR critique of this, which I thought was the most interesting, because this is also like sort of in the, the Shanghai Commune has already happened, obviously, which, it points towards this kind of, you can have, you know, work brigades made up of work teams, right? And so is there a sort of, you know, a smaller atomic unit below the union apparatus that could have its own wage taker fund? I mean, people were speculating in these sort of directions, and the DDR critique was really like sort of suspicious. I mean, I don't know. I'm guessing that this person was an industry owner or high up within the party, and you know, was given control over a lot of, you know, industry. And he saw the problem of this wage earner fund, that you could have something like, let's say, the Shanghai Commune or something appearing where, well, yeah, like Sebe said, you know, the shifting of power, basically, into the hands of, I mean, because you're creating a new kind of class consciousness when people are no longer forced to only think about their economical returns in terms of a salary, but you are forced to think, at least in the standard way that it was put forward, everybody who works for the same company becomes your economical comrade in a way, right? Because if they do better, you will also do better. And you don't all work for the profit of the owner of the company. I mean, obviously, again, like there are many ways you can take this you know, every person being a stockholder in their own company can mean a lot of things. I mean, you have syndicalist problems as well, and like, you know, co-op problems as well, because you're still going to be competing with other proletarians on the market, right? And, you know, so of course there are a lot of issues with this, but yeah, so go on.
But I think the thing about this that would, it was these two topics were the largest topics of the day in the early 80s during Palme's second term, and both of them were obviously very aggravating to the right wing. The one about Soviet submarines in Swedish waters spoke to him being, you know, a traitor or not being tough enough on the Soviets and letting them have their ships in our waters. And the one about the employee or wage earner funds is taking away power from the corporations and the capitalists.
And there's a third one as well. Can I just add one? I think in this trifecta, he also suggested there was this talk about a new draft law that would change the status of the police in the situation of an occupation, obviously a Soviet occupation, and how it was decided that they would not try to fight the occupier, but that the police would work as a police force to, you know, maintain civil society.
Yeah, stability and order.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, okay.
So obviously people who, you know, were right-leaning within the police took this as a great offense, you know. So now basically he's alienated himself from, you know, the parliament, the military and the police, basically. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But so I think this is the politics of the day in the 80s in Sweden. Not going into too much about the international situation, but just looking more within Sweden's borders. And this is obviously very different, and it's a period where it's marked by a lot of conflict. And if you read a lot of biographers about Olof Palme, they say that he was very tired as a politician, and just on a personal level, nagging on for year after year about this conflict within the Social Democratic Party and with, like Marcus said, with the military, with the police, and with the right wing always amping up their attacks on both Palme and the party.
Last Friday in February 1986 was a day of big and small private and public events, as the days were for a prime minister with an extensive agenda. The bodyguards picked Olof Palme up from his home at 8:30 a.m. for one of the week's highlights, which was the tennis match in the Royal Tennis Hall. Afterwards, they stopped at Ström's men's restaurant. Olof returned a suit that he bought the day before. It had been given a thumbs down by his wife, Lisbeth. And after a bit of party political business at his office, a heavier
meeting awaited him. This was with the ambassador of Iraq, and it was mainly on security policy issues. The conversation ended with a task that disturbed the prime minister's peace of mind. It appeared that Iran had access to the Bofors-made Robot 70, despite the fact that Iran was on the arms export ban list.
A grumpy and annoyed prime minister was having lunch with his government colleagues, but seemed to have spaced out when the newspaper Statsanställd visited for a report. This is like an internal parliamentarian paper. This was followed by semlor, which is a kind of whipped cream wheat bun treat in Sweden, with the Norwegian, well, seems to be all over Scandinavia, with the Norwegian ambassador, and then a meeting with Margareta Grappe, CEO of the International Center for the Labour Movement. The day faded away out in mixed activities, and when the prime minister walked in through the front door of the apartment at Västra Långgatan 31 in Gamla Stan, nothing had been decided for the evening. The bodyguards had been sent home earlier in the day. Nothing unusual in that. The surveillance of the country's prime minister was, on his own initiative, the minimum possible. After some discussion with their son, Morten, and his girlfriend, the Palme couple decided to go to the late-night performance of the Brothers Mozart, a movie in which Olof Palme had been offered to participate, but had declined. The couple left the apartment shortly after 20:30 to take the metro to Rådmansgatan, near the Grand Cinema. Down on the platform in Gamla Stan, an overly refreshed Friday celebrant shouted, "Hey, Palme!" And Olof cheered back. Anyone could end up at arm's length from the country's prime minister. And a prospective moviegoer walked so close to the Palme couple all the way from Rådmansgatan subway entrance to the ticket office that he occasionally heard what they were talking about. He, like many others, noted that bodyguards were nowhere to be seen. Once the Palmes had collected their tickets, they stood in the street outside the entrance together with their son and his fiancée. Morten had missed that the movie started at 21:15, so they had to wait in plain sight on Sveavägen for up to 15 minutes. Once inside the auditorium, some people who were personally acquainted with the Prime Minister nodded in recognition. TCO chairman Björn Rosengren and his wife Agneta were sitting in the armchairs just behind the couple Palme, so they had time to talk about work before the commercial started and Lisbeth suddenly shushed them. A moment before the end of the Mozart Brothers, the second movie of the evening at Grand, the Soviet film Come and See ended, just after 11 o'clock. Two friends, Margareta Storhök and Anneli Korhonen, came out from that movie to the foyer. While Korhonen went to the bathroom, Storhök waited inside the entrance. She then noticed that a man was staring intensely through the glass doors. When the visit to the toilet was over, Korhonen also noticed the staring man. And when the friends went out into the street, they felt that he was looking at them with a, quote, tense and anxious look. The man remained outside the cinema, seemingly waiting for something or someone. A few days later, when Storhök was asked to describe the waiting man, she described him as a Northern European, about 175 centimeters tall, with blue eyes and light hair color. She remembered the jacket as half long and light blue, the trousers as dark blue. An ordinary middle-aged man, simply put, but with two details that stood out. According to Storhök, he wore, quote, large-framed glasses and a, quote, light brown cap with ear flaps, end of quote. Several moviegoers observed a waiting person at Grand, including Lars Knubb. He saw a man dressed in dark clothing and a, quote, sports cap with a screen, end of quote. The man was standing to the left of the entrance, did not appear to be a moviegoer, and looked like a cross between TV character Marve Fleksnes and actor Björn Gustafsson. The person made a dorky impression, Knubb summarized.
A few minutes after these observations, at
7 minutes past 11, the Mozart brothers ended. The Palme couple lingered and remained in the salon for a while before going out into the foyer, where Olof was caught up in a brief conversation with a teenage girl who wanted more money for culture. The Rosengrens talked about offering Lisbeth and Olof a ride home, but they never offered in the end. Then out on the street, Olof and Morten stood with their respective partners outside the ABF bookstore, a little bit from the movie theater. They discussed the rest of the evening. At 11:15, the couple separated, and Lisbeth and Olof walked off towards their home in Gamlestaden. Then Morten also noticed a man staring into a furniture store next to the bookstore. Morten perceived him to be around 40 years old, around 180 centimeters tall and heavily built. He was wearing a blue jacket that went down quite a bit over his legs and a cap with a button and probably also steel-rimmed glasses.
Meanwhile, the Palme couple continued their walk southward. After a while, Lisbeth wanted to peek into a shop window on the other side of the street so they could cut across to the eastern sidewalk of Sveavägen, where the large Skandia building dominated the neighborhood. There were far fewer people moving around here. The spouses lingered for a while outside the clothing store, sorry, before continuing home with Olof Palme closest to the facade and Lisbeth arm in arm. At the same time, inside the insurance company Skandia, the graphic artist Stig Engström reached the sliding doors to the reception and swiped his time card in the card reader. The time was 23:19. He wore a dark three-quarter length coat, dark trousers, low shoes and a cap with ear flaps. There were two guards in the entrance, one of whom Engström knew quite well. True to form, Engström exchanged a few words with them before hurrying on.
The two guards saw Engström pass through the entrance of Skandia Huset on Sveavägen before disappearing down the sidewalk. And at this point, Stig Engström and the Palmes were almost alone on this part of the street. Now, at the southern end of the block where Sveavägen is crossed by Tunnelgatan, there was a designer called Anders Björkman. He was slightly drunk after a celebration with some colleagues from Bofors Aerotronic. He caught his breath for a moment before he decided to head home. Now, Björkman was passed by a chef, Nicole Falzi, who hurried past in a northerly direction. He was tired after his shift. And when Falzi had passed the entrance to Skandia Huset, he was surprised to see the Palme couple approaching. He met them without a word. He noticed that they weren't alone on the pavement. There was a man following the Prime Minister at a distance of about 5 to 10 metres. He just figured this guy was a security guard, even though he seemed quite old and, you know, kind of out of shape. He did remember that the man who was following the Palmes was wearing a blue jacket that reached mid-thigh, but otherwise he didn't think much more of it. In addition to the Palme couple and the man walking behind them, there were 22 people in the vicinity of this intersection at 11:21 p.m. Björkman was now very close to the street corner, and an archive worker, Lars Jepsen, had taken a break behind a construction shed just a little bit further down. The other soon-to-be witnesses were kind of moving around Sveavägen are sitting in one of the cars stopped at the red light at the intersection. So apart from Nicola Falzi, who had moved on and was now on the sidewalk north of Skandia, no one was even aware that the country's Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was in the neighbourhood. Anders Björkman saw three people. He got the impression that they were walking together and therefore knew each other. Björkman was only 3 meters away from Olof Palme and Lisbeth when the man walking behind them fired two shots without warning, a few seconds apart, maybe 1 or 2 seconds apart.
Olof Palme collapsed in mid-step and fell forward as if all control of his body had been lost. The perpetrator ran away from Sveavägen and into the darkness of Tunnelgatan. Other people in the vicinity of the crime scene barely noticed what had happened. It was only after they heard the shots that their attention was drawn to the three people in the intersection. as the shots were fired virtually at the same time as the traffic lights turned green for north-south traffic. The cars that had stopped at the red light were able to quickly turn on to the white pavement. Within seconds, three vehicles lined up next to the crime scene. Closest to the scene, taxi driver Hans Johansson parked his white Mercedes. He connected to Solna Taxi to ask the operator to contact the emergency center and remained in the car waiting for a response. In the meantime, he followed the offender with his eyes, running between the wall of the Skandia building and some other construction barracks further down the Tunnelgatan. The offender turned around to see if anyone was following him, but Johansson did not see his face. At the same time, his passenger, Stefan Klantz, rushed out to the shooter on the street just before him. Teenagers Anna Hage and Karin Johansson came rushing from a car that had only stopped to drop them off. In front of the taxi was a Chevrolet van whose driver, Leif Ljungqvist, grabbed his car phone to dial 90,000, but in his excitement dialed the wrong number. The third car was a BMW whose owner, Jan-Åke Svensson, observed Anders Björkman, who was wearing a blue jacket, hat and beard, peering fearfully out of the entrance to the Decorima shop on the corner of Sveavägen and Tunnelgatan. Svensson realized that Björkman should have made important observations, and when he showed signs of wanting to leave the scene, he got out of his car to ensure that the eyewitness remained. This would be our Bofors man. Now Ljungqvist reached the alarm center and said, "Yes, there's been a murder on Sveavägen." "Talk to the police," the operator replied. "He was shot," Ljungqvist continued, and his passenger Jan Andersson added, "I think we only heard one shot," in the background. Jan-Åke Svensson was trying to communicate with Björkman. "You must have seen what just happened here." When the operator delayed transferring the call to the police, Leif Ljungqvist got tired and hung up. Instead, taxi driver Anders Delsborn was the first to reach the police via Järfälla Taxi's switchboard. He too had stopped at the red light. Delsborn pulled over to the curb onto the other side of Sveavägen, where he dropped off his passengers and took payment before hurrying over to the scene of the crime. Behind the construction barracks on Tunnelgatan, Lars Jeppsson heard the shots, and a few seconds later, he saw a man rushing past him. He saw a man rushing past on his way to the stairs up to Brunkebergsåsen. When the man had reached halfway up the long staircase, Mr. Jeppsson dared to leave his hidden position to look towards the junction where the shots had been heard, and saw that four or five people had gathered around a fallen person. Jeppsson realized what had happened and turned to look for the offender, who had reached the top of the stairs. There the man turned around. Mr. Jeppsson felt that the offender was watching him, therefore took a few steps to the side to seek shelter in a scaffolding. Then the man disappeared. The witnesses, who with reasonable certainty were the last to get a look at the killer, were Yvonne Nieminen and Ahmed Zahir. They were at the top of the stairs on David Bagares street and were on their way home when a man came running on the opposite side of the street. Of course, they did not realize at the time that there was a reason to remember this person. The shots had not been heard on the ridge. The running man attracted their attention both because of his haste and because he looked over his shoulder repeatedly while reaching for something in a dark wrist bag. As Nieminen recalled, the man was wearing an unbuttoned fluttering coat to knee height, dark trousers and probably a dark jumper under the coat. He was stocky or chunky in some way, around 175 to 178 centimeters tall and probably 35 to 45 years old. The man did not run very fast, and at some point he slipped in the snow. It seemed exhausting for him to run, perhaps because he was in, quote, poor condition or for some other reason, end of quote. Nieminen and Zahir continued walking on their side of the street, and just above the top of the stairs, down to Tunnelgatan, they met Lars Jeppsson. He had plucked up courage and decided to follow the perpetrator. While the three talked briefly with each other, the murderer ran off into the streets of Stockholm.
At the scene of the shooting, concerned people gathered around Palme while Anna Hag and Stefan Glantz provided first aid. The first police officers on the scene were Inspector Gösta Söderström and a colleague of theirs called Ingvar Winden, who arrived about 2.5 minutes after them. Söderström described the scene later. He said they were standing in a circle, the people on the street, around a man lying on his back in a large pool of blood. His face was covered in blood. His clothes were soaked in blood, and he had a staring look. There was no reaction in his eyes. Soon, a patrol bus from Södermalm security district arrived at the scene. There were 5 police officers in this, and they were ordered by Söderström to resume the chase, you know, to follow the man who'd run off. Hans Johansson, the taxi driver, he met the police officers and he said, you know, he ran up there. He went that way and he pointed towards Tunnelgatan. Now, the officers did not react really at all to what they were being told. And the taxi driver later said that as they kept asking me for my story and what I'd seen, and as they kept asking the people gathered around for their statements as well, I kept thinking, you know, while we're doing this, the killer has run another 20 seconds away and another 20 seconds and another 20 seconds, you know. So the resuscitation continued. Anna Hag, she gave heart compressions while Stefan Glantz tried to blow air into the lungs. And there are accounts of witnesses who were watching this throwing up because of the sight of the blood and how gruesome everything was. Some of the witnesses began to realize who the guy lying on the ground was, and then they started to realize the enormity of what was actually going on here. At this point, we're only about 6 minutes after the shots had been fired, and Söderström was able to inform the control center the victim is the prime minister. He had to repeat this information because he himself could not get his head around just how big this was. And then Palme was lifted into the ambulance, and then with Elisabeth as a passenger, they drove towards the hospital. But the ambulance driver, for some reason, chose a slightly longer route, and so his arrival there at the ICU was delayed. But it didn't really matter because the Prime Minister was dead the second that he'd hit the pavement, to be honest. Lars Jepsen had hurried along David Bagardis Street, where he passed a police car and looked for a person he thought had slipped under some scaffolding to hide. Jepsen then approached the police officer and he gave a description of the man that he'd seen fleeing the scene. The same description that we keep seeing throughout this. Blue jacket, comes down to mid-thigh, and a cap. And then the cop passed on Jepsen's information, and another one asked Jepsen to accompany him to one of the patrol buses at the crime scene so that he could provide further information before he was allowed to go home. By this time, Anna Hag and Stefan Glantz got a roll of gauze from a police officer, and they kind of stood there wiping the blood off their hands. But then the strangest thing happened after this, which is while Anna was taken for questioning to the police station, Stefan Glantz left the scene without giving any information. And he, as far as we know, he didn't actually realize that it was Olof Palme that he'd just been trying to resuscitate and performing first aid on. It was only when he read the morning paper the next day that he realized the context. And then some photographers showed up at the scene, and these first pictures that they took capture police officers setting up the barrier tape and spectators being allowed to leave.
The crowd had grown to around 20 people, and in the initial emptiness, tears were shed by spectators and police officers. The search for the perpetrator continued, but the police had little to go on. Witnesses at the crime scene spoke of a dark blue jacket, which was complemented by a cap by Lars Jepsen. For his part, taxi driver Anders Delsborn said that the offender was an older man wearing a long overcoat and a cap with ear flaps. Both of these descriptions were altered. The police officers who ran up Brunkebergsåsen did not find any suspects and instead had to devote themselves to stopping people in the area to see if they had made any observations. Another 10 or so police patrols joined the hunt. When inspectors Christian Dalsgaard and Lars Christiansson arrived at the scene, they asked Mr. Söderström if he needed help, but his colleague said he was fine. Instead, it was agreed that Christiansson would go to Sabbatsberg, the hospital, to try to get more witness information from Lisbeth Palme. one of the radio operators at the police communication center, ordered a dog patrol. When the dog handler arrived at the scene of the crime, however, he discovered that so many people had been hanging around that it was pointless to let the dog try to track them down. Only about 50 meters away, a 52-year-old man, dressed in a dark three-quarter length coat and a double buttoned cap, pounded on Skandia's entrance door. About 20 minutes after he left work, Stig Engström returned and was let in by the surprised guards who knew nothing about the shooting. Engström was in a state of shock and had difficulty expressing himself coherently. Quote, "There is a man who has shot over there and they say it's Olof Palme," end of quote, was the first thing he said. The guards couldn't quite make sense of his story. At first they got the impression that he had approached Palme and helped turn him on his back. However, the guards saw no blood on his clothes. It seemed that he had instead approached the shot man at a later stage. Mr. Engström claimed that he had given information to the police but did not mention that he had seen any perpetrator. After a while, he called his wife to tell her that he was running late and had to take the night bus home to Täby. However, he was so physically affected that a security guard offered to order a taxi. Engström simply didn't look like he could make it to the bus. He was very shocked. Engström also left the reception to disappear into the house for a while, allegedly to have a cup of coffee. The guards reacted particularly to the fact that he said he couldn't believe it was Palme because he looked so small lying in the street.
At the hospital, attempts to revive Palme were ongoing, and as a final measure, the doctors actually opened his chest up to massage his heart directly with their hands. And in an adjoining room, Lisbeth Palme sat with a nurse. Her back was burning, and the nurse realized that Lisbeth had been a few centimeters from death, really, because one of the bullets had pierced her coat and scratched her back. At 6 minutes past midnight, less than an hour after Olof and Lisbeth had left the cinema, Olof was pronounced dead. And Lisbeth Palme called her sons, and she told them that what the family had feared for years had now finally happened.